our support staff, members of the public media, everybody who's on the platform, you are most welcome. Today we are meeting with the Parliamentary Budget Office. They are going to make their independent assessment of the Division of Revenue Bill.
Recording in progress.
And the second adjustment appropriation bill. Welcome, Dr. Chanchis and your team. Looking forward to your input as usual. But before we proceed, let me check with Darren whether we do have any apologies.
Chairperson, yes, we received an apology from Mr. Mare. Also, we received an apology from our communications officer, Mr. Jabulani Mabuza. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's note to those apologies. Dr. Chanchis, you have got 45 minutes maximum to make your presentation. I hope that's fine.
Good morning,
Chair. Is it fine, Dr. Chanchis, so that I shouldn't speak, right? Remember, we're still going to have time to respond to the questions and comments which will be made by the honorable members. We are very faint. Please increase your volume. Get closer to the speaker.
Can you hear me now, Chair?
We do, but if you could still improve, would appreciate that.
All right. I think I'm stuck in my device. Let's start. I'll just quickly start the presentation and let it run. Thank you so much. Can you still hear me, colleagues? Can you remember?
Just continue. I'll tell you. Just continue.
Yes. No. Thank you so much. Good morning, Chair and members and colleagues. Thank you for the opportunity, Chair and members. I'm with the team of you and always appreciate the opportunity about what that.
Dr. Chanchis?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, please, can you ask one of your colleagues to continue the presentation? Perhaps you'll come. We are definitely struggling to hear you.
Okay.
Perhaps you'll come after. Try to find a better place, please.
All right.
Let me hear you.
Suraj, you're continue. Every time, I hear you coming. Oh, let's just move to the situation analysis. Fine, let's move to the situation analysis. We'll just get on with that.
Okay. Good morning, honourable members and colleagues. Can you please go to the situational analysis? I'll be taking us through the situational analysis of the country as we think about how the division of revenue has been undertaken or what is being allocated to different spheres. And here I'll be covering what different spheres are responsible for, but as well as what is the current conditions of that. So at the national of government, of course, social protection is critical. As we know, large proportions of South Africans are subject to debilitating poverty and unemployment. And of course, institutional support is inadequate, as we know. If you see in the graph on the right, the average household basket is about close to 5,000 Rand now. But if you see there that at the national minimum wage per month falls significantly below this. So if you've got one working member of the household, it means that one person's salary is not enough to adequately support the household of an average about four people to be able to secure the food that they need to survive in the month. And of course, this is not considering the transportation costs to get to work and other things. But here we've put all the other grants so that you can see relative to the household food baskets, what they are. So you'd kind of need multiple of these grants to really make up the food basket. As the president has noted, African women are the face of poverty. So this is something that we have to continuously think about when we think about the distributional impacts of policy and how policy is made. We have seen that during COVID-19, that there's been an increase in the number of households that have limited access to food. And so you see there that the numbers have increased for households from 17.8% in 2019 to 20.9% in 2021, which is, of course, a regression, particularly when taking into account the national development goals. And so there's a lot that needs to be done to address some of the regression that has happened during COVID-19, particularly. Of course, the extension of the COVID-19 SRD grant has provided a lifeline to millions of South Africans, but we continue to notice the PBO that the number of recipients actually receiving the grant is significantly low, even by DSD standards. The DSD had noted that 10.9 million people would need it, but as to date, we haven't seen DSD dispersing this grant to more than 7.5 million people. And so there are many people who are outside of that net. And this is, of course, due to the amendments to the criteria that were introduced to help DSD to fall below its budget allocation given by National Treasury last year. But not only that, we had already estimated significant underspending by the DSD. And so we see there that 9 billion of the estimated expenditure of 40 billion was not spent in 2022-23, which is a significant concern. Next slide, please. In terms of justice and protection services, there's been an increase in the crime reported. And of course, this is a worrying statistic. On average, crime has increased by 9.55% year on year between December 2021 and December 2022. We've put there what the different types of crimes are and how much they've increased by. Of course, contact crimes have increased significantly. We also know that South Africa really has an issue or a large problem of gender-based violence. And so this is one of the areas of concern. In South Africa, we've got one police officer for every 408 people. And this is important because it is higher than other countries, but at the same time, we have to understand the crime incidents in our country, but also to think about quality of policing in itself. So you can have many, many policemen, but not necessarily see a reduction in crime statistics as we see here in South Africa. And in the budget, they've announced that they're going to add 5,000 police trainees over the next 3 years. But again, we see that there's no mention of how the National Strategic Plan on Gender-Based Violence and Femicide will be funded or how that will be implemented from a budget perspective. Next slide, please. In terms of education, there's been a decline of children who 0 to 8 who attended grade R in preschool. And of course, we know that this is there's been a policy shift here, which requires children to go to grade R. But since COVID-19, we've seen a decline. And so most children are actually staying at home. Children from poorer households are more likely to stay at home. And this is concerning as well, because what some statistics are showing is that fewer than 50% of grade one children learn the letters of the alphabet by the end of grade one. And so grade R is very critical in helping children prepare for school. And of course, we know the long-term impacts of not being able to read at these sorts of ages and on what it means on the outcomes later on in life. The Progress in International Reading Literacy Study estimates that the grade four children, and I'm sure many members have seen the statistics, that 78% of children in grade four cannot read for meaning, but they estimate that this number has probably increased to 82% in 2021. So there's been a regression there as well. Next slide, please. And of course, we know that socioeconomic is a large an indicator of whether children will be able to attend school or further schooling after grade 12. And we know that in terms of secondary school, children from higher households are more likely to still be in school. But here we also note that in terms of dropout rates, we are concerned about the cost of living crisis, because of course, even if you go to a no fee paying school, there are still costs to education. And so we find that there are more female children who have to drop out of school or who are not attending school versus male children at 15.5%. And so this is concerning for us from a gender perspective, but also generally from an educational attainment perspective. And as well as we know that education is obviously linked to unemployment or employment or the ability to be employed. And so we see that here in terms of the 7.8 million people who are unemployed, 40.1% have education levels below matric, 34.4% have a matric, and 10.6% of them are graduates. Next slide, please. and 21% in other tertiary education. So at the provincial sphere in terms of health, the figure on the right shows you that there's been a regression in the infant mortality rate. There's been a regression in the under five mortality rate. And of course, the burden of malnutrition still weighs heavily on South Africa. These regressions are significant given that these are critical indicators for how our healthcare system is performing. The public healthcare system remains overstretched and underfunded, as we know that South Africa is not reaching the ideal ratio of one nurse per 16 people. We currently have one nurse per 218 patients. And so when we think about public sector wage bill and you know, the compensation of employees and how many employees, we have to be thinking about how we are significantly below the standards for nurses. There's also a challenge in terms of doctors. But in addition to that, we know that the Minister, Joe Pasha, well, revealed that there were 10,831 vacancies in state hospitals in 2022. And so we've got significant vacancies that cannot be filled for various reasons, including from a budgeting perspective. Also, our primary health care has also deteriorated. We are not meeting the ideal clinic status that we are hoping to achieve. Next slide, please. So at the local government level, of course, we know that local government is the first line of interaction between citizens and government. And for the most part, local government is unable to secure or adequately provide services at adequate levels. And of course, this has created a lot of tension in South Africa. As we know, we see a lot of service delivery protests. We've gone back to pre-COVID levels of protests. So there were 193 protests recorded nationwide in 2022. You'll see that the police also reports on how many protests they attended, but of course, not all of these are service delivery protests. And so it's important that we look at this number specifically as opposed to broad protests. So those protests broadly can tell us a lot about the state of the country. The municipal IQ forecasts that there'll be more service delivery protests because of the heightened frustration caused by load shedding. And so we also have to remember that service delivery has disproportionate impacts, which are gendered, which are geographic, which are racial, which are age-based. And so because macroeconomic policy is not neutral, there are real distributive relations across social groups. And of course, COVID-19 has highlighted to us the centrality of social reproduction. And social reproduction means our ability to meet our basic needs and to reproduce ourselves as human beings for the workforce, for living. And so it's shown that there's gender distribution of household duties, or highlighted rather, because we've always known that there are these gender distributions, the need for cooking, cleaning, and so forth. And when there isn't adequate basic service delivery, it is women really who shoulder the burden. Next slide, please. As you see here, the non-financial census of municipalities 22 report shows that there's fewer people receiving free basic services in 2019. And so the graph there on the right shows that when you look at the data between 2018 and 2019, there's been a decline in the share of people receiving free water, free electricity, free sewage and sanitation, as well as solid waste. These are, of course, critical to social reproduction, critical to household survival, and really are the rights, right? When we think about the constitution, these are the rights that people should have. And so we think about that in terms of regression. Millions of households are eligible for free services, but they do not get them due to the dysfunctional system for registration of indigent households. There are millions of households that are forced to choose between feeding their children and paying municipal services. We'll come back to how costs have escalated later, but there's also significant research that shows that local governments are unable to fulfill their conflicting objectives of financial viability through self-financing and service delivery. And this goes back to the white paper and how we've conceptualized how local governments can raise its own revenue, but also that the efficacy and financial viability of our local government has suffered because of these conflicting goals. Next slide, please. So here we're showing the millions of households that are unable to use electricity to cook. In South Africa, about 90% of households are considered to have been electrified. Some of the statistics, South Africa data shows that in some provinces like Gauteng, there's actually been a regression of the number of households that are electrified. But just because a household has quote-unquote access to electricity. It doesn't mean that they can afford it, but most importantly, it doesn't mean that they use it as their main source of cooking for various reasons, including affordability, including load shedding, including load reduction, which we know takes place particularly in townships. So the ability to use electricity and gas for cooking makes a huge difference in households. We usually emphasize that, you know, maybe households who aren't, or not we, but it's broadly understood that households who are not using electricity are using gas. But if you see the figure there, the number of households using gas are significantly low. And just to contextualize this figure, we actually have 18 million households in South Africa. So if you look at 2019, for example, you're looking at almost a quarter of households not using electricity as a main source of cooking. And of course, if you're not using electricity or gas, it means households are having to use paraffin, wood, and other things to be able to do to undertake this critical activity for social reproduction. Next slide, please. There are a lot of, as I've already stated, there are a lot of financial and operational challenges that hinder local government from delivering basic services. And according to, you know, the literature, the performance is due to a combination of capacity constraints, poor planning and ineffective financial management, inadequate monitoring and monitoring and evaluation in the context of poor government, convoluted political processes, corruption, etc. We are particularly worried about our ability to really assess to what extent households are really burdened. In 2021, Statistics South Africa suspended the detailed general household survey due to budget cuts. And so we do still have a general household survey, but it is not as detailed as it was before. And this is critical because then we need to be led by information, data-driven decisions. That's how policy should be determined. And so without that data, I think it would be difficult for us to assess to what extent we or what policy changes need to take place. And of course, we've also seen the AJSA reports, which points to a serious widespread problems within local government. We know that 28% of municipalities submitted credible financial statements for audits in 2019-2020, which remains a serious concern. And the number of municipalities in financial distress continues to increase, which is really worrying because 123 municipalities pass unfunded budgets. Next slide. The social wage and actual access to services. And as we know that the NDP aims to eliminate poverty and reduce inequality by 2023. And a lot of these measures really are about providing basic services. They're about providing social protection. They're about education, all these things that I've just covered above and more really are outlined in the NDP. So we see the 2023 budget review claims that even though it follows a fiscal consolidation framework, the social wage is protected. The PBO has shown in the past that in real per capita terms, in fact, the social wage is declining. It is not increasing as the as has been reported. In the budget, it reports that 51% of the budget is for the social wage in the medium-term expenditure framework. However, the level of spending on social wage for the entire country seems to have been quite inadequate in the past and currently. So when we're looking at what is going to happen in the next 3 years, we have to also take into account what has happened. The PBO has written a written response or brief about austerity and what is meant and what has happened in South Africa, which shows that there are continuous backlogs and uneven and poor quality of services, and that there's almost, you know, there's been a protracted disinvestment in the social wage itself. So the problem is not incrementalism, as has been posited forward by the Treasury, but that budget provisions over many years have been insufficient for local governments and other sectors to operate properly. Next slide, please. So here we show again the issue of affordability and access to services. And as you see there, that there's been significant increases to rates and taxes, electricity tariffs and water tariffs. So when you look at rates and taxes have increased by 118% between 2010 and 2020. Electricity tariffs have increased by 177%. Water tariffs increased by 213%. And of course, we all know that wages have not increased at this rate. And so people's disposable incomes are declining. And in households where there is no wages at all, you can only imagine what the situation has been. Of course, there are grants and so forth to help within households, but we also note that, of course, grants wouldn't have increased at this rate. And so majority of South Africans, 80% of South Africans, cannot afford the basic services. So there we show that the difference in funded versus actual recipients. So National Treasury has actually provided funding for more households than what households are receiving. So I'll give you an example there in our table. For electricity in 2019-2020, National Treasury budgeted for 10.1 million households, but only 1.89 million households were actually receiving these households, basic household services. And that's because, of course, at the local government level, local government gets to decide who receives the basic services and so forth, which means that a lot of households are not able to actually access it or are not granted indigent household status. And of course, we also know that the free quota for electricity and water is actually does not meet the basic needs for households to be able to sustain themselves. Next slide, please. So government has tried to improve access to basic services, but has also failed, as you can see in the statistics before. There's a significant shortage and inadequacy that is happening. And so, like I've already noted, even though this increased electrification, the majority of households, you know, have much more to worry about. They cannot afford the appliances that they need to use electricity in itself. They cannot not afford electricity itself, and they're forced to choose between buying food and paying for water and electricity. And so here we argue that much services non-payment is due to poverty and not unwillingness to pay, because when we think about the majority of households, that, you know, they're really struggling to survive. And so government has been forced to increase utility costs, even though they are aware that households cannot afford services, because the business model, the local government business model in itself depends on raising tariffs and not necessarily on increasing the levels of free services. And so, you know, the principal source of local government revenue are property taxes and services such as electricity and water. But just here to quickly note that property tax rates and property taxes are not sufficiently redistributive, because they are spatially, when we talk about spatial apartheid, it means that property taxes in wealthier areas is obviously higher than in poorer areas. And so that money sits within the community that it is acquired in. And so we also have to think about how that in itself is not a redistributive mechanism. This money that local governments are supposed to be raising is to fund nearly three quarters of all operating expenditure requirements, which means that tariffs have to be continuously increased to address the needs of the people. Next slide, please. I'll now hand over to my next colleague to talk about the division of revenue.
Nelia, are you coming in?
Yes, I am. Good morning, honourable members and colleagues. Next slide, please. So just in terms of the object of the 2023 Division of Revenue Bill, it is to provide for the equitable division of nationally raised revenue between the national, provincial and local spheres of government. And for this year, you can see the revenue has been divided in terms of the national sphere is receiving 49.1%, provinces receive 41.2%, and local government receives 9.7%. The provincial shares has been split between equitable share and conditional grants. The equitable share makes up 82% and conditional grants 18%. And on the local government side, they receive 59% for conditional grants, 32% for equitable share, and then the fuel levy makes up 9%. Next slide. Members, on this slide, we just want to illustrate, especially on the bottom of the slide, that the 2023 medium-term expenditure framework shows the objective to reprioritize expenditure from national and provinces to local government. However, the long-term trend of the division of revenue across the three spheres of government shows that this objective has not been realized in the past. This is important to note, given that local government has not been able to collect revenue as envisaged in the white paper on local government. Next slide. The slide is just illustrating a longer-term view of what I've just presented in the previous slide in the format of a grant. Next slide. Members, this slide includes the debt service cost, and you can see the rising debt service cost as a share of expenditure has more than doubled since the global financial crisis, consuming expenditure that should be going towards service delivery in the various spheres of government. Next slide. In this diagram, we try to illustrate that when we account for inflation and population growth, the allocation across the three spheres of government decline over the medium-term expenditure framework, reflecting government's continued fiscal consolidation stance, which curbs growth in expenditure over the medium term. Next slide. The table shows the amounts to be appropriated from the revenue fund for a selection of national departments. So on the outside column on the right, you can see the differences since the 2022 appropriations. Members, you can see the corporate governance has increased by 10 billion. When we look at basic education has increased by 2 billion, there was a decrease in health of 4.4 billion. And then the other big increase is in transport of 10 billion. But members, you can also just look at the column in highlighted in green. We always show you this in terms of the transfers that the national departments make. And you can see that in total, 69% of the national allocations are actually transferred. So in terms of corporate governance, that includes the equitable share to local government as well as the conditional grants. Health transfer, almost 94%. And we all know that social development transfer, basically the entire budget to SASA. And then, excuse me, in terms of transport, they transfer 98% of their budget to other spheres of government, excuse me, or to other institutions that provide the services on behalf of them. Next slide.
Nelia.
Sorry.
Nelia.
Yes.
Okay, take a deep breath. Drink water.
Yes, I've got water. Sorry, I have a cold, Honorable Chair.
Okay, we'll wait for you. Okay.
So just members, in terms of the transfers, in terms of conditional grants from the national departments, you can see corporate governance transferred to provinces, public works transferred to provinces, basic education, health, agriculture, human settlements, sports, arts and culture, and transport. In terms of the transfers that I've indicated in the previous slides, these are the transfers for conditional grants. The transfers to municipalities, also corporate governance, national treasury, public works, human settlements, mineral resources, transport, and water and sanitation transfer conditional grants to other spheres of government. Next slide. Members, in terms of the equitable shares to the provincial government, the total average annual medium-term increase is 2.5%. The largest average annual increase is to Limpopo of 3.1%. The estimated total of increases are between 10 billion and 11 billion. and this is mainly for the carry-through effects from the public service wage increase. And just also to note, members, that there is a slight decrease from 2022 to 23 in terms of the transfers to provinces for the equitable share allocation. Next slide. Members, we just want to illustrate with a slide that the individual grants, not just on a high level national department level, but individual grants, you can see most of the conditional grants increase in 2023-2024 since the 2022 budget. There was a decrease of 2 billion for district health programs. And the National Tertiary Services grant also decreased by 282 million. And then in terms of the education infrastructure, we see an increase of 1.3 billion. Human settlements development increased by 688 million. Excuse me. And then the provincial roads maintenance increased by 3 billion. Next slide, please. The transfers in terms of conditional grants for local government. Excuse me. In 2023, 164 billion is allocated as direct transfers to local government, while a further 8.5 billion is allocated to be spent by national departments on behalf of municipalities. So that is basically the indirect portion. Of the direct transfers, 68.3% will be transferred as unconditional funds for municipalities to use according to the priorities determined by councils. The remaining 31.7% will be transferred through conditional grants. And in 2023, government is funding free basic services to 11.2 million households. Excuse me.
Nelia, can't Mapule do the rest of the slides? Are you okay then? Sorry, Chair.
Are you
teaching?
Okay.
Excuse me, I've got a cold. I'm almost done.
Okay.
Next slide on the expenditure trends. Next slide. Members, in terms of the spending trends in the national sphere of government, the first table shows the highest spending departments as at the end of December, and the second table shows departments that underspend or which expenditure is slower than 65% of their budget at the end of the third quarter of 2022. Next slide. Members, in terms of the expenditure on a provincial level, this slide is just to illustrate that the total receipts that has been transferred to provinces are almost at 75% at the end of December, and just to show that in education they've spent almost 75%, health has spent almost 75%, and all the other departments has spent 68.7% on a provincial level. And then just also to note that the bottom there, still on the previous slide, is that expenditure on payment for capital are actually only at 62.8% on a provincial level at the end of December. In terms of expenditure on conditional grants, members, next slide. Just to illustrate or to identify the slowest spending grants in terms of the the COSP grant, you can see expenditure was only at 56%. So that's one of the slowest spending grants. Learners with profound intellectual disabilities, they've only spent 61% of that grant. And then the National Health Insurance grant has only spent 51.5%. And then at the bottom there, in terms of human settlements, there was also very slow spending on the informal settlement upgrading partnership grant for provinces. Next slide. You can move to the next slide. Members, when we assess the efficiency or try to assess the efficiency and effectiveness of expenditure, one has to look at performance as well. And our assessment of the performance of basic education, health, human settlements, agriculture and transport conditional grants in 2020, our assessment actually showed that the performance of the information that were provided in the division of revenue schedules was not relevant to use to do an assessment because there's a two-year lag time between the current year and the actual performance data that is reported in the schedules. And so the PBO was actually forced to use the annual reports of national departments to do our evaluation. So in next slide, the analysis of the information on the conditional grants then shows that the performance on the outputs and the indicators were not well defined. There was duplication of indicators. There was poor or no reporting on actual non-financial information. And in some instances, no targets were set for outputs. And then in some instances, overspending on some of the grants has been accompanied by underperformance and underspending that has been accompanied by overperformance. So reporting on the performance was also not measured against target set. There was incomplete performance information. And what this actually means is that the lack of proper performance information on conditional grants in the annual reports of departments makes it very difficult to determine the effectiveness of expenditure and the impact of the outputs delivered by provincial departments. Thank you, members. I'll hand over to my next colleague.
Sipetelo, are you coming in?
Yes, I am coming in. Seems like my video is not... am I visible in the video?
No, you are not, but we can hear you. Maybe for the sake of time, continue and then show the video if the chair allows. Thanks.
Thank you, Chairperson, and good morning, honorable members and colleagues. I am Sipetelo. I'll be speaking through the local government fiscal space and the underspending of national government project that we've been doing as an office. This slide here, it shows that local governments are self-financing with operating revenue accounting for more than 80% of the total budget. And this comes from the service charges and the property rate as the two sources of the operating revenue. However, Chairperson, the local government finance report that was released by National Treasurer last year, it has shown that the number of municipalities that are in financial distress has increased to 169. This speaks to the issues of poor financial management and the inability to efficiently raise own revenues, as these are some of the causes of the financial distress at the local government. And these issues, they also hinder the abilities of municipality to deliver on services as they are facing with the poor governance issues, financial mismanagement, and the insufficient capacity within the local government sphere. So we're highlighting some of the key issues that we have identified in municipality budget. In terms of the growing grant dependent, we have seen that there is a the growth in the government transfers has increased at a faster pace than...
What happened? We are losing you now.
Chairperson, can I continue?
Yes.
Oh, thank you so much. I was highlighting some of the key issues in municipal budget, which one is the growing grant dependent of the municipalities. In terms of that, growth in government transfers has occurred at a faster pace than the increase in own revenue. In terms of the inadequate maintenance expenditure, we have seen that the delay in maintenance pushes forward the cost, which may have increased in the future due to the degradation of the infrastructure. And in terms of the outstanding consumer debt, there is an increase in the outstanding consumer debt, which is one of the things that we highlight that it possibly causes problems within the raising of the municipal finances. We can move into the next slide. The office has undertaken the underspending analysis. This emanated from the meeting that the SCOA had last year, September, where National Treasury was presenting the fourth quarter 2021-22 preliminary outcomes, and they have shown that there was underspending of about 15 billion from the national government, and they projected that there will be huge underspending in the current financial year. So the office felt that maybe we need to do the trend analysis historically to look at how the budget has been spent within the national government department. And if I were to draw your attention into the second and the third column of the above table, we see that the total appropriation by vote, that they've been underspending, except only in 2019-2020, where the national department has incurred, they overspend on their budget. And the below table shows that this underspending, or the drivers of this underspending, is from the current payment, which is your goods and services, and also the transfers and subsidies, where some of the issues that we find out that it drives the underspending within the national government. We can move into the next slide. So this analysis that we have done, we have summarized some of the issues that we have identified that they were the causes of the underspending within the departments. And the literature that we have done, because we tried to do the desktop analysis, we found that the issue of underspending is not phenomenal only in South Africa, as the literature shows that the other countries also, they started to spend on their budget. And it further shows that the critical contributor to underspending by government, it's the weaknesses in the budget planning and also the execution processes and procedure. It also contributes to underspending. But bringing it home here, what we have found, one of the reasons that has been cited as the contributor to the underspending is the procurement processes, the issues that are relating to the non-compliance to the SCM policy and the regulation, and the inadequate monitoring and evaluation of the SCM has also been indicated by government entities as a contributor to the underspending. One of the other reasons highlighted by the department is the delay in the payment of supplier invoices. It's one of the major reasons for underspending, and we know that the delays in payment of these invoices is in breach of Treasury regulation, which states that the invoices must be settled within 30 days of the receipt of the invoice. One of the other reasons, it's the contributor to underspending, it's vacancies of the critical posts within the national government and entities. So compensation of employees' expenditure is linked to the government service delivery. So the failure to fill these critical posts has a direct impact in the government's ability to use the budget to deliver much required government services to the citizens. And furthermore, the other issue is the interdepartmental systemic issues. We speak here of maybe your inefficient processes, the unnecessary red tapes, your poor communication, which they also build up, and at the end of the day, they deprive citizens of the services. So they all cause the inefficiencies in the interdepartmental project, particularly when we speak of the infrastructure, which also need to be addressed. Also, the other findings, because we also looked at the conditional grant performances, what we have seen is that failing to comply with the conditions set out in the conditional grant, it leads to underspending of the grant. And then when the grant is not all spent, and then the fund will then be returned back to the national government. And therefore, it is important to always link the conditional grant budget to a specific delivery goals in order to manage to spend it all. So these are some of the issues or some of the reasons that has been highlighted by the national department and the provinces of underspending, or it contributes to the underspending. So our analysis raises the important question that if maybe we are not able to show significant level of underspending as a problem, should we not be raising maybe question about the budget adequacy or the quality of expenditure and the performance outcomes, particularly in the light that the choice, in the light of government choice with regard to the reducing the growth of spending. So the office is going also to continue doing the analysis of each vote, looking at the historical expenditure to identify where the areas that department face difficulties to spend and what are the reasons of underspending. So these were the slides. Thank you so much, Chairperson. I'll give back to the Dr. Olandi to continue. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Sepetelo. Next slide. Members, I don't know if you actually noted during the National Treasury presentation, there was a lot of indication of that the allocations from the BFI. So in members, 24 billion was approved for infrastructure projects through the budget facility for infrastructure process of the 2023 medium-term expenditure framework. And just to give some background on this process, so as part of the public sector infrastructure reforms, a budget facility for infrastructure has been established. It is a multidisciplinary facility that brings together varied government expertise to provide recommendations on the technical feasibility and readiness of infrastructure projects. The facility considers the use of blended or hybrid financial solutions that include a combination of grants, debt and equity sources for both public and private institutions, and concessional loans from multilateral development banks. Next slide. So some of the projects approved through the BFI as per the 2023 budget of the medium term includes the Kuga SEZ, 1.8 billion, and you will also see the previously, this funding was through the DTIC and now it's through the equitable share. There was a funding for the CASP program grant, also through this facility, the public transport network grant to the city of Cape Town. And then the George Local Municipality also received funding through this process for the potable water security project. And then at the bottom, you will see all the new projects that were also approved through this process. Next slide. Next. So in terms of the second appropriations bill, members, the revisions to the non-interest expenditure in 2022-23, include funding for the public wage bill. The increases was 14.6 billion and the increases varied between 3 million and 1.9 billion depending on the size of the national department. SAA receives 1 billion to assist with the outstanding historic debt. All government guarantees to SAA will be cancelled. And the proof of funds for the strategic equity partner transaction needs to be provided. And National Treasury will review the strategic equity partner's agreement to prevent future obligations. And then in terms of the post office, 2.4 billion equity injection, several conditions apply, including the placement of the entity under, also to place the entity under administration. And then the land bank receives 5 billion, 3 billion for the blended finance program and 2 billion to remedy its default position. And there was also several conditions that will apply to this allocation. Thank you, members. I'll hand over to the director to summarize.
Thank you so much, colleagues. Thank you, Chair and members and colleagues once more. I think what we're trying to do in our presentation, Chair and members, we really try to emphasize the context, service delivery context, and economic context on which the division of revenue is set out, which is also important over and above the fiscal context in which the budget was presented. And we really emphasize the importance that the social economic challenges shown that the government's spending on social protections is important policy intervention, and we've seen over time how much this has really impacted both the economy and society. I were concerned that the proposals, you know, set out inadequate additional intervention in this regard. For example, we look at crime statistics, really showing some of the concerning indicators over the time. And I think, as my colleagues have mentioned earlier on, that we're really concerned that it's not also only about spending issues, but really there has to be a better alignment when you look at the crime continuing to grow in taking longer to resolve cases and so on, despite more allocation of funds being made. Government has made slow progress in realizing education outcomes set out in the MTSF over time. In particular, we're concerned around the ECD access, where we see low-income households have struggled to get more access, particularly post-COVID-19. Progress on the international reading literacy study estimates that number of children are still struggling, the emotions are still struggling in this regard. But also we are concerned about the level of unemployment, and more so that we've seen a lot of unskilled unemployed increasing over time. Public health care services as well remains understretched and underfunded. And I think it's also post-COVID-19, it's an area that we're concerned it will remain like that if we're not really putting more measures in place to deal with some of the backlog we have in the sector. Next slide, please. Local government plays an important role in this regard. You know, it's an area where the first line of defense for government service delivery is very important. But we're concerned that this growing satisfaction has often been cited as a reason for, you know, service delivery or lack of that, or also poor service delivery within the sector. Total considered government spend is expected to grow at an average of 4.5% from 2.17 trillion to 2.48 trillion over the next MTF. Provincial executive share increased by 2.5% on average over the MTF. Most of the provincial contractual grants increase in the next financial year, since the revised estimated in the last year. The 2023-24, $164 billion in allocated to direct transfers to local government, while $8.5 billion will be allocated to the local municipalities there. Underspending remains concerns. But I think context matters, and hence we're trying to do this project to say we need to look at what really is underspent, because the underspending itself does not necessarily mean there is no need for service delivery or there's no need for economic activities or support for households or economy in that regard. Despite several interventions and that are put in place, much has not been really addressed and in terms of the progress, or the progress is a bit slower in this regard. As Nelly mentioned just now, budget facility. A budget facility for infrastructure has been established, and there's a need for a continuous oversight to ensure that it really brings more closer to ensuring there's better spending in this regard. Chair, I think I want to stop there and really thank you so much once more, and the members for the opportunity in this regard. Thank you so much. We'll wait for any input, and thanks so much to the TBO team in this regard. Thank you, Chair.
Dr. Chances and your team, thank you very much. On your presentation, and it's raising a lot of questions that we should think about. But honorable members, let me allow you to interact with the presentation. You know how we do it. Who wants to start?
Matafa.
Honorable Matafa. Yes, honorable members. Honorable Matafa.
Kaiso.
Honorable Kaiso. Honorable members. I've got honorable Matafa. I've got honorable Kaiso. Okay, you'll indicate. Let me allow honorable Matafa to start.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, Chair. Good morning, Dr. Janjis and the team, colleagues, the public at large. Chair, let me start by thanking the presenters for the presentation. Very, very informative. And I agree with you, Chair. It makes us have more questions that maybe we can pose. And I also wish to take this opportunity to wish Dr. Olandi a speedy recovery. The first question, Chair, that I have is on the issue of the disinvestment in the district health program grant. I think it was about 200 million plus. Now, I'm interested to find out if whether the PBO picked up any reasoning behind this kind of a reduction. And I'm raising this question, Chair, on the back of what the PBO has stated in terms of the nurse ratio, that we are not in line with a global standards. Our ratios are too high of a patient to nurse. So the health system has quite a lot of vacancies that are open. But again, we also are concerned about the state of health as far as the services that is offered is concerned. So is there any reason in that maybe the PBO would have picked up what could be the reason? The second issue, Chair, is on the concern that the PBO raises on the increase of municipalities under financial distress. The committee will agree with you fully. This is a matter that we've been raising many times before. So I'm interested to find out what would the PBO recommend as far as the funding model of municipalities are concerned. The presentation on page 19 speaks to the revenue sources of municipalities. Previously, Chair, you would remember some members raised the concern that the funding model, which is reliant on municipalities raising rates and taxes as their sole revenue source, might be problematic. And the presentation here says that about 3/4 of the expenditure is expected to be covered by these two sources. So what would you recommend as far as the funding model is concerned? And would the PBO agree that maybe this argument of the reviewal of the funding model holds water? Is it something that should be pursued? Chair, the third point is on slide 35 with the title Efficiency and Effectiveness of Conditional Grant Expenditure. What would the PBO recommend to be a prudent reporting model as compared to the current one of the two-year reporting schedule? Because the PBO rightfully states that it is very difficult to consolidate and analyze data coming from these reports because there is a two-year lag for that to happen. So what improvements would they recommend that the model follows? Chair, on slide 40, the presentation touches on the reasons for underspending. And I personally think that the presentation is spot on as far as those reasons are concerned in terms of the capacity to spend. And I'm also happy they are linking it with the challenge or the behavior that for us does not make sense, where departments or municipalities and provinces are not paying suppliers within 30 days as required. Because you find that most of the creditors units in the finance departments are fully staffed. Why are they not paying invoices is still beyond us. But having said that, Chair, in our last engagement with the National Treasury, the Treasury provided a report of interventions undertaken by them together with COGTA in the attempt to capacitate municipalities. But they also agree and accept that the progress has been slow in showing an upward trajectory in terms of the improvement as far as these challenges are concerned. Now, what I have is as a question is to find out from the PBO if whether in their opinion, the DORA is in any way indicative of a financial investment towards the support of these external interventions by Treasury and other stakeholders where they pick up. SALGA, we know they also have their program to capacitate municipalities. So the question there, Chair, simply put, does this budget allocate resources so that this interventions are supported for the improvement of the capacity in municipalities? Chair, those are my four questions. I will pause there and appreciate the opportunity to participate in this discussion. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Matafa. Honorable Kaiso.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair, and Dr. Janjis and your delegation. Honorable Chair, there are a number of questions that one would like to pose here, given the presentation that has been made by PBO. Firstly, Chair, I think the issue of criteria for which is being applied by DSD when it comes to, you know, approval of this grant, it does seem to have an impact in as far as, you know, reaching out to a large number of populations, you know, subjected to poverty and unemployment. And this has, you know, the availability or access to this grant has actually, you know, demonstrated care by the government to our suffering people. But then I think we did raise this matter of the criteria that has seemed to be stifling this process to reach out to even more number of people who are supposed to receive this grant. I think it's very, very much important that there has to be some sort of an engagement with the DSD, such that now things must be ironed out when it comes to criteria. Of course, this may lead to understanding at the end of the day, as it has been indicated there, with that background that a number of people did not were not covered as a result of that criteria. So I think there has to be something that needs to be done. So yes, the budget for policing, I mean, in the Division of Revenue, we could see and in the adjustment appropriation after, we could see how the policing would at least receive an increase. But I think it's going to be proper that we insist on what has been prioritized as far as gender-based violence is concerned, that the department must provide with that, you know, that strategy plan, which is going to address this issue of gender-based violence, because we could see a number of, you know, divisions have been, you know, are going to benefit out of the second adjustment preparation from the national prosecuting authority and all those branches. So now on gender-based violence, it may, you know, put a, it will play this picture. So I think it's important that there should be a gender based violence strategy plan that is we should receive from the department itself to say when we interact with the department, we write to them to say, give us what you are going to, how are you going to spend that at the end of the day. We should, as a community, get that understanding, because it's very much key. And a number of interventions, as far as you know, a policy statement has been made with regard to gender-based violence. So if you can ignore that, we may not see at the end of the day what budget is it going to benefit out of through the implementation of the strategy, or failure to implement the strategy. I want to agree with my colleague Ben. You see, the issue of primary health care, the regression in mortality rate is a big worry that we need to be concerned about, because the issue of mortality rate is also one indication as to whether the economy is performing or is going to perform or not. So I think it plays a key role in as far as also, you know, making an assessment of a proper performance of the economy. Now, if we've got a regression in mortality rate, it does tell you something that needs to be corrected. And I think this is not the first presentation by PBO. The PBO did make a warning or a caution around this particular area. So why I'm raising this, Chair, it is because now there has been a decrease in as far as, you know, overall decrease in as far as funding on health. But at the same time, I hear that there is a 51% performance in spending in as far as district health grant is concerned. And therefore, I want to get from the PPO, is it the reason that the grant was decreased by 2.1 billion? Because I think these talk to each other. And I didn't get, because the district health system or the district health grant, it has an overall contribution towards, you know, advancing the national health insurance system. So if that one collapses, we're going to find it very difficult to say what is now happening as far as national health insurance is concerned. So I just want to understand from the PPO's point of view, whether is there any relationship between this 51% health grant decline or under spent related to this decrease? Because I do suspect that it might be related to this 51% spending there. Now, on State South Africa, there was previously a presentation by PBO around State South Africa, if I'm not mistaken, maybe Dr. Jansen will remember, and honorable members will remember this, around statistics being underfunded to do their performance so that we have a correct statistical data, so that a determination in as far as progress in this particular area can be easily determined. But this was then, you know, made it very difficult because of that South Africa could not obtain relevant information in advance so that the planning could be, you know, be a proper one. So now I want to get to the reason of this suspension. What did you get as the reason for suspension of suspension of budget at the state of South Africa. So I just want to know what were the reasons which were said to be the one that affected this suspension. I want to check maybe from the opinion of the PDO, because you are saying there's an argument between Treasury and you seem to be raising another a counter argument when it comes to issue of austerity budget. You argue it differently because your statistics differs with those of the Treasury. Say over 61% Treasury says now the budget is redistributive or division of revenue is redistributive, but you come with another determination or analogy to say, in actual fact, there is a decline in as far as social wage is concerned. But then when we read from the report, the report from Treasury, we do get a sense that now the division of revenue in as far as social wage is concerned, a chunk of budget goes to social wage is around 61%. But you argue it differently, so no, it's below. So it can't be, you believe in something. So I just wanted that clarity. Is it what you are saying so that we know that you completely have a different view as far as Treasury is concerned? Now, on the issue of PBO is raising, Honorable Chair, that there's always been a problem in as far as information flowing from the department so that the PBO's office can be able to make a determination as to whether, to what an extent does the department perform here. I can make an example. For instance, there has been you previously reported that there's been a lack of information in some important achievements from the department.
Yeah, on red injury time, please wrap up.
Okay, no, I'm wrapping up, Chair. Yes, I just want to understand, because we have been raising, this question has been raised several times. It makes it very difficult for PBO to can have a correct information. So, Chair, let me stop at this juncture. I will come at a particular stage if time is still available. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honorable Kaiso. Robin Changwini, please come in.
Thank you very much, Chair. And thank you to Dr. Yankis and his team for the presentation. Mine is just on two or I think it's more or less comments or than questions. On the, I think it was the patient to nurse ratio that we are currently having within South Africa. And I think that is why we are having currently a collapse and the current protests within and many of our healthcare facilities, because I think nurses have just reached a point where they can't anymore, because our health system in the country is collapsing for the poor. Many of our communities go to hospital, but then if they go to hospital, they instead come back more sicker than or come back with another disease. So it is something that the state needs to really pay closer emphasis on it. And I just think the research that Dr. Yankis and his team are giving is it's very enlightening. So I want to find out where's this, after they have reported, where's this report going, Dr. Yankees? Is it going to certain departments that needs to pay and closer emphasis on the findings that you guys have made? Because I think if it doesn't reach them, it would be a waste of your energy and resource, because some of this can really help them within solving some of the crises that they're having. And then the issue of electrification, very true. Many of our households are, you know, you see it when you are doing your oversight chair or your political work, constituency work, when you are going into these communities, many far beyond before load shedding, communities couldn't afford electricity because it was so, it is so expensive in our country. So you have many communities that subsidize their cooking with cooking outside on wood, on with wood and fire, because some of them can't even afford gas. To just save up the little electricity that they can afford, maybe to light the to put lights in the house. So the cost of our electricity in South Africa is, it's very expensive. So I want to find out from the team, have they made any possibly research to find out also in terms of to divide the households, in terms of your child-headed households, your households that are headed only by women, say in terms of their research, and then find in the affordability of services. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Nhlanhla. Let me check Roma Tafa. Let me see. Send this. Roma Tafa.
Thank you, Chair. Maybe just a quick one. If maybe the PBO would have done an analysis on the impact of load shedding on the revenue of municipalities and probably provinces. Thank you, Chair.
Honorable Kaiso, thank you, Roma Tafa.
Chair, only one issue here is around the issue of vacancies. I don't know how many times did we try to seek, you know, how this matter has been, is being handled, because it's very much problematic. I think we need to write as a committee to the department on this 10,081 vacancies. And the issue of vacancies, Honorable Chair, it doesn't arise for the first time again in this, before this committee. And this is one area which the department needs to pay attention to. And also, you know, assistance to fund those vacant positions to be filled. So it doesn't arise for the first time. So I don't know what are the reasons which this matter does not being attended to from the PBO's point of view that they interacted with the department. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Is there another oral member who would like to say something, oral members?
Okay, it's Honorable Sarupan, if I may.
Please, Honorable Sarupan, come in.
Thank you very much, Jen. Apologies for not being able to come in earlier. I was walking around trying to get my reception signal with load shedding. Chair, I just want to pick up where Honorable Batafa left off around the impact of load shedding in municipalities. I think that the PBO's analysis on municipalities, it's partly true. Yes, there's issues of financial management and mismanagement and capacity. But what the PBO's entire slide was missing was what I raised with Treasury recently, and that is that the funding model is broken, because the entire funding model is built on reselling of services and property rates, and reselling of services is the big one, and electricity is the biggest revenue generator for municipalities and the reselling thereof. And when you've got 12 hours of load shedding a day, you lose half your revenue every day. and PBO is missing that. But further, Chair, and this tacks on to what Honourable Matapa asked, the detailed analysis that needs to be done is not just that financial impact, but also the cost on generators to keep critical IT systems functioning, to keep water treatment plants functioning, to keep wastewater treatment plants functioning as well. All of that needs to be factored in. And every level of government is spending a tremendous amount of money on diesel and generators just to keep the very, very, very essentials going. And I think we do need the PBO to do an analysis of that as well, Chair, because we are doing a disservice if we're just going to say local government is fully incapacitated, everyone out there is useless. It's not true. Up and down, there are lots of local governments where there are lots of people working very, very hard up and down the country. And there are lots of places where the services were fine and things were functioning until a couple of years ago. And then, Chair, my second question to PBO is around the unrecoverable debt that they pointed out, or debtors book in municipalities growing. Have they considered the impact of COVID and the recent anemic economic situation in the country on household finances, as well as inflation, which is preventing households from being able to pay? Because when you've got to choose between buying food, paying for your fuel to transport to get to work, and then paying your municipal bill, obviously a lot of households are choosing to prioritize food and transport over their municipal bills. And I think that is what we are seeing. So we also need a proper analysis of that, Chair, if we're going to be able to look at municipalities in a more rational way. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Saropen. Let me join the oral members in thanking the presentations. And as you said, it's quite enlightening on a number of things, and at the same time making us to ask a number of questions. Obvious, I think just to underline the point that has been made by both Honorable Saropen and Honorable Matafo, that there is no doubt that there is a direct impact of load shedding on the revenues of the municipalities as far as reselling of reselling of electricity to the end user. That's a direct one, but again, there's an indirect impact on the revenues of the municipalities, as you see that the number has increased from 86 to 175. The indirect one, for instance, would be about the businesses which are going under and being unable, well, obviously decreasing the revenue which goes to the municipalities. I just thought to finish that line of thinking. Yes, my question. just want to check from PBO. Are you aware of the scale of medical legal claims and its impact on the budget of provincial health departments? Where is it standing at the moment? And the ability of the provincial governments to pay those legal claims? on the 2023 Division of Revenue Bill and Financial Distress Municipalities, the committee is concerned about the increase in the number of financially distressed municipalities, as I said, from 86 to 175, just in the space of about 5 years. So just want to check, how is the division, as far as PBO is concerned, the Division of Revenue Bill, responding to service delivery challenges and revenue shortfalls in financially distressed municipalities? On slide 18, PBO, you are arguing that non-payment of services is due to poverty, not unwillingness to pay. While the statement may be true, there have been many cases of affluent households, government institutions, and big businesses who still do not pay for electricity and water. What would you say about the capacity of municipalities to make those who can afford to pay? Because we are arguing here that it's not everybody who's not paying, who's because you can't pay, or perhaps it's because of poverty, as we are arguing in some of the slides. There, we spoke about the decrease in the conditional grants of health, I think, yes. And I just want to check what would be the impact of that on NHI. And in your own assessment, we have been talking about NHI. Do you think we'll ever get it? It looks like it's taking too long. What should be done with 123 municipalities that pass unfunded budgets? It looks like they year in, year out, they do that, but no carrot or stick type of an approach in dealing with this, because that's where the problem starts. Once you pass an unfunded budget, it becomes a problem. I'm not very sure what is the point that you are making about the social wage, which is already at about 60% of consolidated expenditure. If my understanding is it's wrong, please say so, or pardon me. But I just wanted to check what would be the implications of the increase of the social wage on the sustainability of the fiscal. We always agree that the solution to many of the budgetary problems that we are having is for us to increase to increase economic growth, the attainment of ERRP. So I just wanted to check from you the capacity of municipalities to attract investments to their localities, because it's to maintain and attract new investment into their municipalities. Perhaps related to that is a question of municipalities being allowed now to generate their own electricity. What's the progress in that regard? Do you think there is a capacity to do that? Let me see how I put this one. Just want to get your opinion. the usage of conditional grants versus equitable shares, equitable share for local government. Do you think that this is the efficiency of service delivery? If you were to write an exam question, I would have asked that critically assess the delivery method of conditional grants and equitable shared local government. So I just want to hear your critical approach to this one. As you know, there's always been underspending on local government equitable share with negative impact on service delivery. Why did you decide to do this? Is it still relevant now? Because we only do it with local government equitable share. When it happens to other levels of government, we don't treat the equitable share in the same manner that we are dealing with the local government equitable share. even honorable members here have been bemoaning the sufficiency of the funds that go to local government, but at the same time we come here and talk about under expenditure again on the resources that have been allocated to local government. What type of interventions do you think we need to make at that level? Because as you know, we sound like a vinyl record when it comes to this underspending thing. whenever we deal with expenditure outcomes, we know that there's going to be under expenditure. But I'm specifically looking at this level of government where we always bemoan the ability of municipalities to raise their own funds. But from the nationally raised revenue, we allocate funds to municipalities. They still come back, they're not being spent. What type of interventions that you think we need to make? On the second adjustment appropriation bill, there's this thing that SAA will be put under administration. Then we are having a strategic equity partner, and we are again recapitalizing SAA. What exactly do you want to achieve by putting this under administration? My hypothesis was that once you get an equity partner on board and so on, the questions of management and everything, those are the boxes that you tick. But what do you, from your understanding, what do you think that you are trying to achieve? And as you do that, please talk to exactly what does putting SAA under administration mean? Yeah, I think you've got a full plate, Dr. Chanchis, of the things that you need to respond to. And as I always say, if there are things that you still need to go and research on or perhaps get more details, we always welcome that. Dr. Chanchis and the team.
Thank you so much, members, for the questions. Quite a mouthful there. I think for the team on the platform will help me to go through the questions. But I think some of the questions are very interlinked quite a lot. So, you know, I'll touch on some of them quite interlinked. I think, you know, the first thing I want to start with really is around the way we've contextualized our presentation. Because I think, you know, in our brainstorming discussion, you know, on this, we said, look, let's first set the context of how service delivery and economy and really broadly how is it fading in a context of the budget allocation or division of revenue in this regard. And I think
I thought I must interrupt you before you proceed. You see the spot from which you are making this input, please don't change it. Please don't change it because you are so audible. It's not funny. So whenever we start, please make sure that you put a marker where you are. We are making a presentation. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I'm in the office, so I'm always here. I think there was a bit of a glitch there. You know, I'm in the office, so I'm always here. Thank you so much for clarifying that. So I think one of the biggest contexts here to say, look, you know, it really boils back to how we see government spending, you know, relative to the purpose of it. Because the issue of you know, increasing government spending, particularly in the core areas, really is an issue of really looking at it in a way that how do we see the spending of government really impacting society or impacting the economic development? And really, the sense, our concerns around there's a decline in real spending core functions in these areas is precisely that. Who argue that actually, you know, there are issues of efficiencies that have been discussed a lot, which we also raise those. But I think generally the understanding should be that government spending has to be seen beyond just within a fiscal context. Because when you increase, I mean, there's a debate around social wage. When you increase social wage, when you spend more money on education, on health, really, you are dealing with issues of productivity, you are dealing with issues of inequality, you're dealing with economic growth itself or economic development itself, because when you spend more money in infrastructure and spend more money on these areas, you are in a way creating jobs over time. Last year in the MTPS chair members, we raised a slide that we put out on our presentation of fiscal framework. We said, when you look at the macroeconomic performance of our economy since the 2012, which is when the fiscal consolidation has put out, we clearly see that there's something wrong here. We clearly see that there has been, you see that actually we've seen more unemployment, we've seen more disinvestment in the economy, we've seen more decline in social in the socioeconomic indicators. And our concern is that that should be a clear indication that declining government expenditure actually has more opportunity to hurt the economy than actually doing better, particularly if you look at government spending within the narrow context of fiscal context without looking at the broadly understanding of how government spending impacts society and the economy and in the context. And clearly, the evidence that shows that we've seen the time we started implementing, taking this fiscal stance, we've lost a lot of jobs, we've lost, the economy has not grown quite a lot. We've seen in real capital, we've seen decline in some of the and debt has increased as opposed to debt decreasing. So I think that's a very strong message we want to emphasize there. To say we see the budget within that context of influencing the economy, dealing with socioeconomic challenges, but also as an investment, because you have more children accessing ECD, you are likely to improve on your outcome of education in the later stage. And if we're going to plan in short-term planning without really taking those into account, we're concerned that actually it creates more harm than fix the economy over time. As I say, particularly when you look at it in narrow sense. Maybe the big question here is the issue of whether we need to prioritize what the budget has to focus on, rather than look at the whole budget. If that's the discussion, then let it be. But I think the issue we have here is, look, the reality is that you should not expect the better outcomes of the government indicators if you're not going to spend more money investing in really improving those economic indicators. I'll give colleagues later to deal with the issue around austerity and so many. I know it's on the platform. I think in our context, certainly, the issue of local government, definitely, we have raised these concerns before. There has to be a relook at the model itself and in many of the instances. And I think I agree with the members and the chair that certainly the funding model has to be looked, particularly when you look at what has happened over time. Even post-COVID-19, we've seen many households struggle. And hence, one of the presentation, I think Nelia has noted the issue of the efficiency in reviewing indigenous policies, and how that really reflects the reality in society, and that really reflects the capacity of local government in the area. And certainly we agree with raises before, we agree. And what else worrying, which we discussed in the fiscal framework debate, was that the more we say, obviously we are saying more households, the proposal is saying more households should move away from the grid to generate more generally, the more their own energy. And that has to be factored in, because that would mean lesser revenue for local government sector over the time. And we support the debate around that. But again, this requires more empirical analysis to be more substantive, particularly the cost of load shedding within the sector and so many other things. And I think another issue which I've picked up quite a lot in the literature and trend, the issue of leadership in municipalities is a very important issue. Leadership in the context of ensuring that we've got capable leaders in the municipalities, it's very important, because if you look at our underspending project, we raise concerns around key critical areas. And I think AG has raised over time saying, if you are going to appoint a municipal manager, if you are going to CFO, appoint CM, those critical engineers, if you have capable people, definitely municipality will not be able to function the way it's supposed to be. And I think it's a very important issue, which the oversight functions, parliament, COGTA, NCOP, all the oversight function, National Treasury, has to emphasize a lot. And I recognize that National Treasury and our colleagues and court have worked a lot trying to build capacity, but I think it's a very important part of it in really ensuring municipalities are able to spend the mandate allocated, let alone collecting the mandate they have. Leadership in local government, it has to really be a fundamental issue that gets raised. I agree. Yes, I would say some of the area committees function that has to be invited to the committee, because you're concerned about the issue of the, I mean, last year we raised this, but I think we're saying it's a teething problem. But I think this is coming very concerning for us, because you see so much need in society of support and build a useful program. We've raised this before. There's clear evidence that SRD has been one of the most important other factors, other grants have been most effectively as transfers directly to low-income households and poor, which has made huge impact in society. The issue around policy, police portfolio, justice portfolio, is very important, because it's not only about the budget issue. And I think it's also an issue of better alignment, but also ensuring that there's a clear risk strategy and really dealing with key areas. And I also support the idea that it's probably one of the areas that the committee want to invite as well. The issue of, before I give the colleagues, there's an issue of conditional grants, our opinion is very, I think it's a empirical work that is quite around there. But I think it's always been our concern that obviously conditional grants are put out on specific functions that have to be performed, which is quite linked directly to the policy at the national level. But I think what we've seen over time, there has been a lot of movement in some of the areas, but that our concern is that it doesn't mean the need has actually been there. Maybe there has to be a review or rethinking around how this way of spending has to be more targeted, but also how can it be used to ensure that the functions within either the province or local from which this money has been used to support is actually more effective and used together in that regard. I think I'll stop here and I'll give Nelia and Siraj and the rest of the team to comment, to give inputs in that regard. I'll see you on my left now. Nelia, do you want to come in before Siraj comes in as well? Thanks.
Yes, thank you, Tumisani. I will just give a short comment on the decrease in the health budget allocation, members. I think the main reason for that decrease now is because the budget since 2020 to 2022 was really elevated because of our additional funding that we allocated for the COVID-19 vaccination. So it seems to be very high, but it is because of the base since 2020 was much higher due to the additional funding for COVID. And then the efficiency and effectiveness, specifically on the reporting of quarterly on conditional grants. Members, there is a really sophisticated system in place in terms of the PFMA for quarterly reporting for national departments on the APPs and for quarterly reporting on provincial departments. And those quarterly reports are published on the websites in on provinces, and they are also on a database. All that information is on a database at the DPME. But the reporting on conditional grants actually falls through the cracks. The DPME, when they took over the quarterly performance or the planning processes of departments from the National Treasury, they didn't take over the reporting on conditional grants. So national departments still report to Treasury on conditional grants, but it's such a comprehensive and complicated system that they've implemented, because they report on, firstly, on business plans, which are very comprehensive. We actually indicated previously the report on a quarterly basis from the National Department of Health is 300 pages. It's a long narrative report, so it's very not useful. Or it's useful, but it's not really user-friendly. So I think if we need to improve, we really need to look at to implement the system that we have for provinces to report on the APPs, that they also should system. If they could also then publish that on the website or even on the database at DPME, or if not on a, on the website of the National Treasury. There was something else. In terms of the legal claims, Honourable Butlesi, at this stage I don't have an idea. We will have to go to provincial departments of health to basically investigate what the legal claims are. But when I was still in the provincial treasury, it was always a huge issue, the increase in the legal claims. But I think they were quite a bit of interventions, but we haven't done further research on whether those interventions has actually decreased those those claims. And then in terms of the NHI, we haven't looked at lately on the progress for the NHI, but in my view, on health, my view was always that each and every cent that we spend on health in terms of the improvement of infrastructure or the improvement of our personnel that we have, the numbers of personnel, everything must contribute to provide a proper national health system. You also wanted to know something about the unfunded budgets. That is still a big problem. The research that has been done indicated that most of the municipalities that publish or approve unfunded budgets is municipalities without a municipal manager or a CFO. And then the council actually also has got a huge role to play, because council approves those unfunded budgets and it's illegal. It's totally against the law to approve an unfunded budget. But councils do approve those unfunded budgets. So it's in terms of the capacity, but it's also in terms of council that should not approve those unfunded budgets. Also, in terms of the administration, put under SAA under administration, members actually, the Treasury indicated that they recommend that they put the post office under administration, not SAA. And then there was also a question raised about the equitable shares between local government and provincial government. The equitable shares of the two different spheres has got different purposes. The equitable share to local government is really to provide the services to the for the indigenous policies, and the equitable share to provinces are mainly, or the biggest proportions are for education and health, and that is actually for the compensation of employees in those sectors. That's all for now. Thank you. I can hand over to my next colleague.
Thank you, Nelia. Let me give Sibu Siwe to come in, and then Sipetel, and then Siraj will come later. Sibu Siwe, come in.
Yes, I'm here. I just wanted to respond, and thank you to honourable members for all these questions. One of the questions was about the detailed general household survey, and to remind members that in 2020, the Statistics South Africa Council actually threatened to resign because of the significant budget cuts that had been undertaken. And so in that year, National Treasury did slightly increase their budget allocation. And so the detailed GHS has been suspended due to budget cuts specifically. And so it's important to note that. I want to speak broadly to our understanding work, and to say that our understanding report does not necessarily cover municipalities, but to say that we did cover medical legal claims in our report, where we talk about how some of the understanding that is occurring in programs is because money is being reallocated towards medical legal claims. And as an example, we noted the Eastern Cape there. And just from a methods perspective, to tell you that the understanding work, what it shows is that departments at the provincial and national level are not necessarily spending or underspending by more than 2%. And I think that's something that we have to reckon with, to say what is the size of underspending, but also to say that in terms of the understanding, understanding, because it's not as large as we thought it is important then to see which programs are understanding. And some of the issues we see, and when we think about NHI specifically, is that we do not give departments the leisure or the grace to learn. You know, it's very difficult to implement a new program, for example. So if you allocate a department a lot of money to implement a program on the go and expect that everything will take place in that year, it won't. And so some of the underspending data that we see is that some programs, especially new projects, do take some time to actually be undertaken or to be implemented effectively. And to say that from an allocation perspective, our allocation system really punishes those who do not spend fast enough, as we know. And so we have to think about, you know, what are we concerned more about? Is it about quality of spend? Is it how quickly you spend the money? And to think about this, particularly at department levels, where, you know, like I mentioned, for example, there's new projects, or it's a, as some of you would know, if you've ever done construction on your house, it doesn't go as planned. But also I want to draw the attention of members to this comment made by Treasury in their document, a framework for achieving spending efficiency in a fiscally constrained environment. The Treasury does explicitly note that the approach to fiscal consolidation has a significant disadvantage, and I quote here, they say the significant disadvantage of this approach is the fact that some programs become inefficient as a result of large reductions. And so why do I raise this? It's because there has been fiscal consolidation occurring, which has led to the inefficiency of some programs, which has led to further cuts to these programs. And this is a question that must be asked to Treasury about what are the spending reviews that are being undertaken. And when we talk about the district health grant, for example, you know, Nelia has already mentioned that we're coming down from a COVID surge to some extent. But at the same time, I think it is important that members ask the questions about what have been the implications of some of the budget cuts and how they've actually eroded the capacity of the programs themselves to then be able to perform later on. And I just want to, on the last comment here, to say, in terms of the electricity question, I think we, you know, in every problem, we have to look at it from a macro, meso, and micro linkage, right? At the micro level, as we've already indicated, households are really struggling. And I note the comments about some households who do have money.
Again. Ms. Nalsajari, please mute Matladi.
Thank you. So I note here that, of course, there are people who are wealthy or departments that are not paying or who are not paying for electricity. But what we wanted to drive here is the question of the majority of South Africans, of the households, of, you know, the more than half of our population that lives in poverty. And that has to be centralized in our question about understanding at a micro level kind of the strain that is being faced by households specifically. At the meso level, of course, we're looking at municipalities and what happens. And these are the questions around revenue generation as a result of micro impacts, right? So we're looking at the ability for municipalities to be able to raise the money that they need, their indebtedness, and so forth. And then we need to look at the macro level, which is really there where we are looking at ESCOM and we're looking at the fiscus itself and how the fiscal model framework impacts from micro level, which is households, to the meso level, which is municipalities. And so I think with the electricity conversation, we do need to look at this in a very integrated way. And I think everyone here has mentioned the ways in which the issues are being perpetuated and to just also note that we haven't divided households by female-headed households versus other statistics. We're at the mercy of what Statistics South Africa can provide at a disaggregated level. Thank you. I'll pass on to Sketelo Siraj.
Thanks, Sketelo. Come in.
Yes. Thank you. Some of the questions came about the business model of the local government, and as honourable members have said, that the business model for local government it's not really working. And in some of the slides that were presented by Busi, where he was showing the situational analysis, and this is a point that you are also making, that we are agreeing with members that the business model is really not working because it relies on generating revenues in order to provide services, but also household can always afford to pay for those services. So they end up having to choose between buying food or having to pay for these services. And if food is a need, then they are not going to be able to pay for these services. So local government, on the other end, they are not able to raise sufficient revenue. So what they do, they end up raising tariffs in order to generate more revenues. But then households can't really afford to pay for those services. So this is a dilemma, or this is a situation of the business model at a local government. In slide 37, we show that there is a slightly increase of the operating revenue as a share of total revenue at a local government. One may attribute that to a slight improvement in terms of revenue collection, but we know that they could do more, local government could do more. So these systematic issues, they are still there and they are hindering the ability of municipality to collect revenues. And in terms of the increase in the number of municipalities in financial distress, as Honorable Matafa has asked that question, these municipalities, you find that some of them, it's either they don't have permanent municipal manager or the chief financial officer or both of them. They are only having the acting of these municipal manager and CFO. So this also speaks to the question of the instability in terms of the leadership within the municipalities, and also the capable leadership, as Dr. Jankis has said. There was a study which was done by Local Governance Sector Education and Training Authority last year, which had findings that the councillors or municipal ward councillors across the country were not appropriately skilled in managing the council affairs, and that they were struggling to even do the report. So those are the kind of issues, or those are the kind of the question one can bring in terms of the capable leadership within the municipalities in respect to the financial management and the critical skills gaps that are there or that has been identified by that report in that. And also the other issue with regard to the number of municipalities who are in financial distress is the issue of the unfunded budget, as Dr. Holland has also touched on that. The report from National Treasury indicated that the unfunded budget has increased significantly over the recent years, in fact, over the past 5 years. And then that municipality, they adopt the unfunded budget, but they also fail to contain their expenditure within the expected income level. So the issue of approving the unfunded budget, it also contributes to the inability of municipality to deliver on services. Bosi answered the question that our analysis on underspending only looked at the provincial and national government and not sorry at the local government. Thank you so much, colleagues. Oh, one last in terms of the local government and service delivery. And we know that Treasury have a municipal service delivery and the capacity building grant. One can hope that maybe they will make some strides in terms of improving the capacity within the local government sphere. Thank you so much, colleagues.
Siraj, do you want to come in?
Yes, please, with your permission, Honorable Chair.
So I think my colleague spent a lot of time covering a lot of the questions, so I'm going to focus on the question of the social wage, but also this issue of austerity. And I think what we're seeing, and I really thank the honourable members for their questions, is we're actually seeing in very concrete terms the link between division of revenue, the appropriations overall, and the finance side of things, and how the austerity actually ends up playing out within the whole economy, and the links between the local, provincial, and the national government. And here, I think, let me start with the social wage. So the point that we were making was that we're not saying that the Treasury's numbers are wrong. Maybe one can question whether they're using the right measures and the right function groups or breaking that up enough. I think it's important to realize that we've had huge backlogs for a really long time, even predating democracy. And so the question about is, have we been spending enough? And what does that mean that we haven't been spending enough? And then to then point out that, we haven't been spending enough over so much time, but then to point out that, well, the social wage is this percentage of the budget, as if that is a great thing. That is what we need to talk about. And I think that we move on a very short-term perspective, where we see budget after budget, and the PBO keeps asking, where will growth come from? And that's a really serious question. And we're not seeing a budgeting, taking a large, grander vision about social change and the role of governments in improving infrastructure, but also improving the ability of children to go to school, for parents to feed their children, increase their ability to learn, for productivity to grow, for households to be able to use electricity, but also for the country and the businesses to have a stable supply of electricity. What does our underspending over years and years mean in terms of that? And then on the social wage, I think people forget that that social wage is on the whole country, not just poor people. And the people who are actually who are disproportionately benefiting from the social wage are those people who can actually afford medical aid, those people who can invest in pension funds, those people can send their kids to private schools. We were talking about nurse patient ratios. Sorry, I just need a sip of water. Honorable Chair, I can continue.
Before you continue, Doc, I was just asking what's happening at PBO?
What do you mean, Honorable Chair?
You seem to be having flu, all of you there.
we infect each other, Honorable Chair.
We're a family, Chair. We're a family.
I can see that.
We have to work together. And so we bring our heads together and think about issues, the germs can move
really,
easily.
Really putting heads together here. Yeah? Continue.
Thank you. And thank you for your concern, honorable members. So I think when we're talking about the nurse to patient ratio, the people who actually can afford private medical aid have a much larger ratio than poor people. And just like inequality, and we talk about per capita spending, per capita GDP not being a proper reflection of incomes in this country because of inequality, that's true as well. But when we talk about the social wage, the important thing to understand is that for that private healthcare system and private medical aid and basically private businesses in general to survive, they have to build on a platform of infrastructure, governance, all kinds of administrative systems, regulations, laws provided by government as part of the social wage. You can't build that. And so they inordinately benefit from that, and they don't actually pay the true costs. And they don't pay their fair share in taxes or the true cost of what it actually means to send your kid to private school and private medical aid, because they actually, there are all kinds of externalities linked to the social wage that's leaking away from having a fairer share to each person, and especially the poor in the country, than to everybody else. And so we need to move beyond this kind of superficial accounting discussion of the social wages, this percentage of the budget. It's really not useful and practical, and it doesn't help us. The second point is then linking all of this to austerity. And what the PBO has been saying for a long time is that for government to actually support growth in this economy, we need to spend and build the resilience of poor households. And as I was saying, we need to be able to send our kids to school where they actually learn and they have enough food at home so that they actually eat enough and are healthy enough to go and learn and be resilient to germs and all kinds of things, but also the productivity of the economy grows over time. We need to be able to invest in infrastructure, and our budgets just aren't enough. And our budgets aren't enough because we don't have a vision. We're taking a short-term perspective where we don't look at what kind of socioeconomic outcomes we want in terms of decreasing unemployment and poverty and unemployment, poverty and inequality in the future, but we're looking at our targets in terms of what is the budget deficit? Are we paying out our debt over the next year or the next 2 or 3 years? And to make the point that we've been trying to make a lot of time, I recently saw a presentation that a famous economist called Jeffrey Sachs gave to the African Union, and imploring them to spend much more money to provide electricity, to provide education, to provide the infrastructure needed in their societies, and saying that Africa is spending much too little. And he used the number 70 in a really interesting way. He said that if you take your growth rate and divide it into 70, the number you get is how long it's going to take you to double GDP. And he said in China, when they were growing at 10%, that they could double their GDP every 7 years. So in that 40-odd-year period, they could do that six times. So the economy grew 32 times over 40 years. In South Africa, we're looking at, I worry that we're looking at 1% GDP a year, but even if we manage to achieve an average of 2%, it would take us 35 years to double the size of our economy. We're not taking that vision and looking at the impact of austerity on our economy and our people and our ability to deal with poverty, unemployment and inequality and to grow. So the Honorable Chair asked this question, are local governments able to track investment into the economy so that they can actually have growth and they can maybe increase? I think he was also inferring that they could increase their own revenues. And growth actually is something that attracts investment. I think investment follows growth. It isn't often, it isn't the other way around. It's all related, but we need to have that growth. And so we need to have that vision to think about how we can spend. And just to end off with, to say that, you know, if you are able to grow your economy at 5-7% a year through the government taking the lead in that kind of expenditure, making sure that we build productivity and infrastructure and people can work, the debt to GDP ratios mean almost nothing. If you think about China over the last 10 years, the way in which the economy has grown and doubled, say in a period of 15 years, and what that has meant for, you know, how much debt they would have. They've just, in response to the COVID, they've gone to all kinds of crises, they've actually increased a huge amount of debt in society to grow and to use infrastructure development and other things to build and grow. So I'm not saying China's our model, but I think we need to think about what growth means and what austerity does to that and what that means for the country in the, you know, in several periods of medium-term expenditure framework. Thank you very much for the opportunity and allowing me to talk for this long, Honorable Chair.
Thank you so much, colleagues. Thank you, Chair, members. I think we've covered most of the questions. You know, there's some common areas that were raised a lot around local government, which maybe we would ask the committee to send as more of a more empirical work around the issue, of course, of the load shedding on local government revenue, the issue around the conditional grants as well. We will really look into those as more of an empirical work going forward. But I think some of the work, Chair and members, we will provide some of the inputs around the government functions during the appropriations bill around a lot of questions around information and so on. We'll provide more information then. So I think some of them will really put them down as a research work for the committee. I think just learning last point, definitely there has been concerns around the medical aid costs at the provincial level. Definitely the big major issue at the provincial level that has been raised, even though so a study center shows that most of the funds does go through that. But I think we will require more empirical figure to give to the committee at the later stage. Chair and members, thank you so much for the opportunity. We're happy to follow up questions in this regard. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Doc and your team. Can I check oral members? Okay, let me start with oral Matafa. Anything that follow up, one question that would like to make, if any, oral Matafa?
Thank you, Chair. No, I don't have any questions. I'm covered sufficiently. Thank you very much.
Yes. Honorable Kaiso, anything?
No, I'm covered, Chair. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Honorable Langwini, anything from your side?
I'm covered, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other member who would like to have a go to on the PBO? No.
Chairperson?
Yes, Honorable Mugana.
Chairperson, today I enjoyed what is normally called carefully listening.
Yes,
I listened carefully and even the responses from questions. But then perhaps not for today. If Dr. Sanchez and Tim when going back to, look, when they spoke at the beginning of the wage bill and what it takes, you know, negotiations and all, I had questions in my mind, but I felt, no. Let me put a pause for today. Dr. Janjis, just go and when I was at the level of the unionism then, Honorable Matava will remember, we had discussions about professionalism versus unionism. Now, when you are talking of these wage negotiations and all, there are two things there. One would be, Chairperson, the question of morale, generally. And particularly when you are talking within health, that what would generally happen is that immediately the morale of our own employees goes down, then there would be moonlighting. And I doubt if a normal person was actually made up to survive working for longer hours. So what it means then is that one would actually put effort where he, she gets comfortable in terms of remuneration and all. That's one part. And then the second one there would be, I understand, we came in with the rationale of the workforce and the standards. But should we continue with this mode of operation when we are talking salary negotiations and all, that it always ends up to picketing and going to the streets? I was just thinking aloud around that, Chairperson. However, I listened to the flow of discussions and I was happy. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Honorable Nzana. PPO, anyone wants to have a take, or you don't have to do it now, as Honorable Nzana said, but if any thoughts around this? Okay.
We probably want to have more of empirical work on this issue, but I think what we have said, thank you so much again for the guidance, for input. I think what you said last year, and I think we will probably keep saying it, that the bargaining system has to be made work, because without that, I don't think we'll really move much forward. And because obviously without that system working, Chair and members, we would probably not have progress and we'll have more destruction, and which delays more services, which impact on actually the low-income households more than the higher ones. So our position remains, the bargaining system has to be restored and it has to work, and there has to be some consensus going forward. I think we can do some critical work for this, for the committee over time, but I think that's the position I want to state. The bargaining system has to be restored and it has to work. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank you, Doc, again, and the team. As I conclude on this agenda item, I just wanted to say, Lucille, when you spoke about the question of under expenditure, you raised the issue of what are we concerned about, quality or, I'm paraphrasing you, quality or that budget has been spent. And my response is those two are not mutually exclusive. Want both, because when we talk about underspending, we are measuring institutions, departments according to their own budget. They would have said we'll be able to do this by such and such a time with this budget and so on. So our assumption is that they would have taken all the variables in that equation. But just then, so it's not an either or. Sikufuna konke, everything must happen, and again the impact on the communities. Two, I think Dr. Siraj, you see, I think we still need to do more work about how we make our municipalities attractive to to investments, right? Those factors which are very critical, and work on them. because at the end of the day, we may, at national and at provincial, may do all these other things, but all said and done, whether when you establish a business, it should be in a particular municipality. What is it that these businesses are looking at, and so on and so forth. I think we do need that scientific discussion and look at the successful municipalities, those that have been successful in attracting investment. What did they do? At better ways of generating their own revenues, and that's a function of, by and large, of businesses which are in that municipality, and the people who are in that municipality working and being able to pay for their services. So it's important that we should have that conversation. I'm just throwing things that perhaps you may want to look at as we continue interacting on the different parts of the budget. Honourable members, I think that's thank you very much, PPO. Let's go to the next agenda item. Dr. Sanchez, you want to say something?
Thanks, Chair. I just wanted to add a point there to say, certainly one of the sectors that has largely been affected by lack of investment is construction sector. And you know, one of the way that local government has or can in attract investment is really investing in these infrastructure, social and economic infrastructure. Because that means you are crowding in more companies to invest, but that creates more jobs. I mean, just come thinking out of my feet here. It's a very important area that has evidently shown has created more investment at a localized level, and it creates more jobs at a localized level. But the fact that we've seen, even within the conditional grant itself, infrastructure spending being taken away, but also even at the council not being able to invest in maintaining the plants, maintaining the water plants, maintaining infrastructure, roads, you know, at the local level, has really made small medium enterprises suffer quite heavily, and the lack of more investments in the economy. I just want to raise that point. So it requires empirical analysis, but I think one of the simplest ways we show bare in many of the municipalities, its lack of investment in municipalities in the infrastructure, social infrastructure. It's made flow shut down businesses and so many other things. Thank you, Chair. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Doc. Busu, please come in. You've got a point to add to me.
Chairperson, I was saying I definitely agree. We want both. But what I was raising there is a question of whether our system incentivizes one more than the other, right? So is our system designed such that departments are punished when they do not spend the money versus if, you know, they send the money back or they just spend the money, which, you know, sometimes we call fiscal dumping. So a department could spend 100% of their budget and then maybe get allocated more money. But the question, you know, which one do we value? And I think some of our research, you know, I think it's okay for a department to say we haven't been able to fully implement this plan because we've got vacancy shortages or so forth. But then it requires for government to respond differently to say, how can we help you to spend the money, as opposed to you weren't able to spend the money and now we take it away. And so, you know, it's how we think about the incentives in the systems itself. I mean, the system disincentivizes against over expenditure, right? So we know that, but it doesn't really say much about understanding. And in the PFMA, there's an upper bound limit, but there isn't a lower bound limit about how much of your budget you should be spending. And just as a last note, adding to what Suraj just said, to say, you know, maybe what we're seeing in terms of underspending and the reason why underspending at a macro level is low, in terms of our 2% threshold that we applied is because they already have such narrow resources in the departments themselves. So therefore, they have to spend the majority of the budget. And lastly, to note that, you know, we can't always expect 100% expenditure in itself. But yeah, so that's my last comment. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Noted. We'll see. thank you so much, Darren. In the next agenda, I can thank you, PBO, Darren.
Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you. We don't chase you, you may remain in our meeting. We're very transparent, Doc and your team. Darren, do we have any announcements?
Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, Chair. Friday's meeting, 9 to 1, comments by SAGA and the Department of Cooperative Governance on the Division of Revenue Bill. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Thank you. Remember, don't forget that, honorable members. Our members, support staff, everybody on the platform, thank you very much for attending this meeting. The meeting is adjourned.
Thank you very much, Chair.
Recording in progress.
The Chief Justice, and it's the same process. And therefore, you are incorrect, sir, by suggesting that by not being vetted by an institution that had gone rogue at that particular time, and it was known, it was in the public domain that this institution had gone rogue. And that institution, I had been told by journalists just after this last interview on the Gupta lending matter, that it was the institution responsible for the first spy story.
Yeah, okay. All right. I'm going to add you, maybe let me make it quick here. I'm going to add you that